Welcome back to Schneps Connects. Hopefully you've been avid listeners of the Schneps Connects podcast, and I'd love you to subscribe to the podcast so you're aware of all of the new episodes that come out. You can do that on all streaming networks or at podcast.schnepsmedia.com. So today I have a great conversation with Stuart Wetzenson. He's third generation owner of two of New York City's most iconic restaurant brands, Tony's Di Napoli and Dallas Barbecue. As a family-owned restaurant group, the family has built deep roots in the fabric of New York City dining. Dallas BBQ has been a city staple since 1978, famous for its Texas-style ribs, chicken, and steaks, now serving locals and visitors alike at more than 10 locations across the city. Tony's Di Napoli was founded in 1990 by Stuart's grandfather and father, Herb and Greg, who brought old-school family-style Italian dining to the Upper East Side and Times Square. And it's become known for its generous portions, lively atmosphere, and classic Italian comfort food. These restaurants represent decades of hard work and growth, all while preserving old school hospitality while evolving in one of the most competitive food cities in the world. So looking forward to chatting with you, Stuart, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Josh. That's quite an intro. Happy to fill in the pieces, but appreciate the kind words and happy to talk about what we've done and what we're doing and happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. You know, I'm in a family business. I'm second generation. So I know each generation, you know, sometimes it gets harder and sometimes it's super successful. I always say that restaurant owners and people in media are very similar in that we're all crazy because these are tough businesses to be in. So, I mean, I would really just love to hear the story of your family's journey into the restaurant business. If you don't mind sharing perhaps a little bit about, you know, going back to your grandfather and of course your father.
Yeah, I'll go back all the way with actually my great-grandfather was in the concessions business, owned and worked in different concessions and he had candy butchers at theaters and hot dog stands and riverboat concessions. And that was his business. And my grandfather, as a young boy, went out to the Army Reserves in California and saw early concept McDonald's, came back to the East Coast and with a little help from his father, started Wetzen's Hamburgers, his take on the early drive-in hamburger concept. And that peaked at 72 locations in the early 70s. And he had quite a ride that was publicly traded. He was in his late 20s around that time and saw a lot of success. And ultimately, McDonald's came to the East Coast and the competition was too much for them to withstand. My grandfather rebuilt himself throughout the 70s and 80s. And in around the late 80s, my father, somewhere around 18, 20 years old, got involved and helped him run a satellite location down in Jersey. That was an early iteration Dallas BBQ. And together they grew the company into, you know, something more of a semblance of what it is today. And they opened Tony's Di Napoli together as a passion project in around 1990. That was kind of their ode to Don Pepe's. If you know of Don Pepe's, was down in Ozone Park, Queens. That's, you know, where the family would have all their get-togethers and gatherings and meals. And my dad grew up around it, and my grandfather was a longtime fan of it. And they actually had a fire that kind of coincided with Tony's opening. And some of their cooks helped us get off the ground. And a lot of the recipes are kind of carryovers from Don Pepe's. And that's kind of the origin story of Tony's was really an ode to that style dining that my family so loved.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. Yeah, I know Don Pepe's. I used to have an office in Howard Beach. So, you know, that was very close there and it was terrific and still is.
It still is. You know, it's a little different. All restaurants are a little different, but it's still great and it's still, you know, classic. And, you know, we have a lot of respect for those guys. And here we are 30 years later.
That's amazing that your grandfather was so 40. Successful. At such a young age, you know, to be able to build a business like that, but talking about how he had to rebuild it, what do you think it is about Dallas Barbecue in particular that's kept it so relevant and beloved now for, five decades?
Dallas Barbecue, it's beloved by real, true New Yorkers and tourists alike and, you know, now kind of all spots of New York now that we've been around so long, but it's honest food, honest value, good service. We treat everybody with respect, with dignity. And, you know, we became a staple for New Yorkers.
Amazing. Really, I think, you know, for any business to be able to operate that long, but particularly the restaurant businesses, is really amazing. Talk about the unique aspect of operating, you know, a restaurant, not just here in New York City, but anywhere. Is what are some of really the challenges, especially a large, high volume restaurant like you have?
The business comes with an immense, you know, series of challenges. You know, there's a comparison I've heard made where, you know, a dog is running to get the ball, but then there's a little distraction. He sees a squirrel out of one side of his, you know, eyes and a treat on the other side. He's, you know, the dog is being pulled in a million different directions. The restaurant business is that 100 times over. There's always, you know, a pipe burst, a new law you're dancing around, a issue with a neighbor, an issue with the city, a natural disaster, you name it. You're just constantly fielding distractions, and to keep your eye on the prize and work towards growth and, you know, stay positive and optimistic and keep making, you know, investments into your future and taking on these projects that, you know, have a huge investment and an upside that could easily get pinched with, you know, tremendous amount of risk. It's a very hard business to keep trudging in. And, you know, we've survived and grown out of our conservative nature. There's, you know, a tremendous lesson learned by the ups and downs of Wetson's that's very instilled in our blood. We're very cautious with debt. We're very cautious with partners. We're very cautious with location. And, you know, we continue to grow in a very slow and steady way that's sustainable.
No, that's great to hear, and a lot of really good lessons for any business, no matter what you're in. So you have these businesses with really great tradition. I feel like a lot of people know these brands in New York City in particularly, and they kind of, you know, have a thought in their minds of what that is. But I have to imagine that the business, in order to be so successful for so long, has evolved. So what would you say that you think about in terms of what has to change, what has changed, and then maybe what will never change?
You know, it's a balancing act, because if you're constantly trying to evolve to every new trend and every new, you know, customer need, eventually you just become like a washed out diner with a giant menu, and you offer trying to, you know, have something for everybody, and you lose your authenticity, you lose your soul as a concept. You know, it's a balancing act for us of staying relevant, staying up with new trends, staying up with new product offerings, but also keeping to our roots, keeping to our, you know, our tradition and our history, and not losing sight of that at all.
No, that's really great to hear. So how many restaurants is it total between the two brands?
We have two Tony's de Napoli's. We're building a third right now in Manhasset, Long Island. Very exciting project. And we have 11 Dallas barbecues. We're in the Brooklyn, Bronx. We just opened up in Secaucus, New Jersey. We have two in Queens. We're in Times Square, Chelsea, Upper East Side.
So personally, I've been to both and I love them, but they are big footprints, the ones that I've been to. I have to imagine that you have a lot of staff.
We have a lot of staff, at times close to 2,000 people. And, you know, we have a lot of overhead. We pay big rents and we're in these big prime locations, but that's been our niche. And it's been a big part of how we hold on to value, by having the scale to, you know, work on a smaller margin, but, you know, do the big gross to, you know, have a great full-time GM and a couple supporting managers, and have that kind of owner presence level manager on the floor at all times, even if, you know, we can't be there ourselves at all times. It's all about scale. And we're talking about restaurants that are anywhere from 300 to 800 seats.
Wow. Yeah, that's big. Talk to me about culture, because I'm big into, you know, company culture. How do you keep the culture in your company?
Well, we treat people very well. There's a lot of tenure in the company. I have, like, you know, kind of my party trick on a meeting is I'll walk them through a few locations and just kind of grab people at random. Hey, hello, you know, what's your name? How long have you worked here? And I'll just kind of tap random people. And it's just throughout the whole company, everywhere you look, you have, you know, this guy worked 20 years, this guy worked 30 years, this guy worked 15 years. It's remarkable. And, you know, a lot of it is owner presence. We're, you know, me and my father, my grandfather, we're in the stores all the time. We're available. We're an ear. You know, we've helped people through hard times. We'll, you know, give someone a loan if they need it or whatever. You know, we're very compassionate owners, and people make good money. People have clear roles and responsibilities. Not to get too in the weeds, but our whole, you know, system of waiting tables and support staff lets them focus on sales and service and not be bogged down with too much side work and a lot of the stuff that people kind of try to tag onto those jobs. And it's a good place to work.
That's terrific. Talk about yourself. I mean, I'd love to know from your standpoint, did you always know that you were going to get involved in the business?
I kind of leaned towards it from a very young age. And there was never like a full conscious shift, but I was a kid where, you know, if I wasn't in school, I'd go to work with dad. That was what I did. And I would ride shotgun with him, as we call it, and stand around and listen all the time. So I told you there's all these distractions and constant little headaches you're dealing with. I sat in and listened to hundreds of them. I'd be standing in a circle with 3-4 people, some of whom I work with now today as an adult, and hear their ideas. And if I had an idea, I was welcome to throw it out there. And I was very comfortable with these people. And then, you know, probably around sophomore or junior year of high school, I got it in my head that I wanted to pursue this professionally and, you know, seek an education in it. And, you know, worked very hard to get myself into Cornell Hotel School, graduated in 2011 and moved to the city and went to work pretty much immediately after.
That's awesome that you knew what you wanted. That's terrific. That doesn't always happen in family businesses. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So you've been through some ups and downs, I'm sure, in the business, especially the restaurant business during the pandemic. What lessons did you take away from moments like that?
I could sit here and talk about COVID for hours. COVID was one of the hardest things I ever went through. You know, besides closing a restaurant that I had opened a year prior to COVID, a different concept, I watched a lot of people, you know, struggle, and we bobbed and weaved. We did really creative stuff. We rolled out a very sophisticated drinks to go program, unlike anything people were doing in the city. The drinks to go law, a lot of places were using it as a way to have people kind of gather on the sidewalk and drink. We took it as an opportunity to package our products and distribute them through third-party delivery companies in tamper-proof cups and beautiful displays, and really did it first class. A lot of our locations were in too busy of areas to build the outdoor sheds, and a lot of our customers really hated eating that way. They wanted to be in air conditioning or heat or, you know, away from the street. So one very cool thing we did, and I don't think anyone did this, when they permitted 50% capacity, we took extra space. And so like in Rego Park, Queens, for example, there was an empty Pier 1 that had closed next to us. So you had this 10,000 square foot vanilla box with HVAC and linoleum tile floors. And we threw some posters on the wall, placed tables spread out, and doubled our capacity overnight.
Wow.
And we,
I didn't realize that.
We were able to basically hit 100% occupancy spread out over two times as much space and service people in a nice way. And it worked. It helped us survive. We did that in Times Square. We did that in Rego Park. It was very cool.
That's really smart. And I didn't realize that. That would have been a good story for us back then.
Yeah.
That's kind of an extraordinary thing, COVID. Have there been other like bumps in the road or mistakes that you made that you kind of have learned a lot from? Because that was really outside the box thinking to just, you know, try to make something when business is so bad and overcome it.
Yeah, we're in a position now, and it's been a slow burn, but pretty much over the past decade, including COVID, there's just been a tremendous uptick in our costs and a tremendous amount of inflation to our customer base, especially our real middle class kind of New Yorker customer. And our profit margin has been squeezed. It's less than half on a percentage basis than what it was, you know, 10 or so years ago. And that represents us eating the costs to keep value. You know, some restaurants right now are really thriving in the high-end segments, but we're a value-based business and we have to offer that to our customers. And if we were held by some private equity firm or some investors, they would say, no, you got to raise your prices. And every time we raise our prices, we lose a little bit of our segment. And so we hold on to value at our own detriment. It's very tough.
Listen, I'm sure you get loyalty in that case. Clientele that really, you know, come to love you.
Yeah.
What do you think about when you think about hospitality and customer service? Because I feel like customer service is so important.
We've really pride ourselves on great service and great hospitality. Something that we've, you know, been doing for many years is offering that same level of great service and hospitality to all walks of New York without, you know, judgment or prejudice. And we're very proud of that. I'm a little cynical towards kind of the Yelp culture. You know, for a thousand great hospitality transactions that are offered, you know, the one angry one goes and puts their feedback on the internet, and it's a very toxic environment that way. But, you know, we're learning to get better and trying to take feedback where we can and use it constructively.
Yeah, I feel like people are much more inclined to put things up when they're not happy than when they love something. For whatever reason that is, it just seems to be the case.
Yeah, it's the premise of the brand. The word Yelp itself is basically saying, here, Yelp when you're angry. It's not about giving good reviews like a TripAdvisor or something.
Yeah, for sure. I know a lot of small businesses that have a lot of concerns. Let's put it that way. I'd love to hear just a little bit, maybe thoughts of advice from you, because third generation business, a successful, thriving, growing business, what would you say are pieces of advice that you would give, maybe that you learned from your grandfather, your father, or just, yourself by doing the work you do?
I've exercised a ton of refrain in my own creative desires by focusing on a brand that has a lot of history and legs to it. You know, the temptation to go and open up passion projects and flex my culinary muscles and put together beautiful design and, all the sexy elements of the hospitality business. It's always there, but Dallas BBQ is something I'm tremendously loyal to. It's like a fire that needs coal shoveled into it. It needs the love, it needs the guidance, it needs the growth of, family ownership. It can't be left to its own devices. So I bear a lot of responsibility to that. And I tell people in the industry all the time, when I talk to friends and restaurants and stuff, is scale, think big. The same work that it takes to run a 100-seat restaurant sometimes could be a 300-seat restaurant. You're still negotiating a lease and hiring and firing and scheduling and recipe developing and all that. You're doing a lot of the same work. The scale gives you freedom and gives you, a bigger earning, obviously, but the ability to step away and look at it from the top down without being caught in the weeds of day-to-day management comes from scale. As a creative, like the outreach that I have in our scale with these 300-400 seat restaurants. I mean, I come up with a special and I sell a few thousand in a weekend. It's just
Wow.
immensely gratifying.
Sure. I love it. Well, listen, I'm personally super excited about Tony's DiNapoli coming to Manhasset. Is there anything that you can share?
I'll tell you, all that refrain from beautiful design and creativity, it's coming to surface in this Tony's Manhasset project.
Yeah, I bet.
We're building a spectacular restaurant. We hired a great design architect out of New York, and the place is just on paper, it's beautiful, and we're in the last phase of our permitting right now, and we should be open hopefully fall this year.
Well, congrats. I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm sure it's going to be super successful. So it's a pleasure talking to you. Congrats on all your success, and I really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thanks, Josh. Appreciate your time. Have a nice weekend.
You too. Take care.